Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season Ticket. I'm Chris Gasper. It's Thursday, November 30th. A very special guest today, one of my favorite people in all of Boston sports media. We are joined by Tony Maserati, co-host of the Felger and Maz Show on 98.5 The Sports Hub. Maz, what's going on?
I'm flattered. If I'm one of your favorite, it must be a short list.
It would be about as short as your list of NBA players you like, and we'll certainly get to that later. But you are one of my favorites, Maz. You know that. I've told you, Maz is somebody that I looked up to when I was coming up through the ranks, and that's the truth.
Well, look, I'm flattered, but you need to aim higher, Chris, because you can do a lot better. Trust me.
Right. Thanks, Maz. I appreciate it. So what I want to jump into is the Red Sox offseason here. You're talking about a team that's coming off back-to-back 93-win seasons and back-to-back American League East titles, but they're sort of a disappointing outfit at this point because they have not been able to get out of the first round of the playoffs in either of the last 2 years. So this is a big offseason for them, Maz. What do you think that they need the most, and what moves would you like to see them make?
Well, look, to me, there were three clear areas that they needed to address going into the offseason. Number one was a power hitter. They needed a middle-of-the-order bat to provide power and, frankly, inspire some fear in the opposition because I think they lacked that badly this year. They still haven't done that. That's number one. And then second and third, probably in this order, I would put a clubhouse presence that can really offer some leadership in the clubhouse, and then I'd put the manager third. So obviously they've hired Alex Cora. I think that will help. I don't think it solves their real on-field problems. I think that those relate more to power and player character and competitiveness and, frankly, experience, particularly in the postseason. So we're just getting rolling here. We'll see how this thing goes. But to me, the number one need is a power bat. They have to go get a power bat.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that, Maz. They really miss David Ortiz's presence in that lineup. And you look at the teams in the American League that they're competing with, the two teams that were in the American League Championship Series, it's the Yankees, who led the majors in homers with 241, and the Houston Astros, who went on to win the World Series, were second in the majors with 238. The Red Sox were 27th in the majors in home runs and dead last in the American League with only 168. So I agree, they need a presence in that lineup. They need power in that lineup, somebody who can get them basically easy runs. But I don't want Giancarlo Stanton. And it's not because I don't admire him or love him as a player. I just don't think he's a fit for this market. And we've seen guys come here, whether it's Carl Crawford, even Adrian Gonzalez, who was productive but didn't like it here. Certainly David Price, everybody's aware of that. This market's not for everybody. And I'm not sure it's for Giancarlo Stanton, who's sort of just been hanging out in Miami, where there's a really laissez-faire attitude about sports, particularly baseball. And he can just kind of do his thing. And then he's going to come into the bubbling cauldron of negativity, fueled by Felger and Maz, that is the Boston baseball experience. I just don't think that's going to go very well.
So, Chris, let me ask you this, okay? Who is going to handle it well?
Chris Sale handled it well.
Okay, but again, did we know that about Sale coming in, or did we suspect it?
Well, here's what I would say, Maz. If you look at Crawford and David Price, and I know Price was in big markets, air quotes, Detroit and Toronto, but where do those guys grow up? They grew up in a small market, Tampa Bay. And you look at Sale, yes, I know the White Sox aren't the Red Sox, and they're not even the Cubs, but Chicago's a major media outlet, and I think that really made a difference for him as opposed to somebody like Crawford or David Price.
See, I just don't think the White Sox qualify as a major media market. Again, my two cents, I know it's a big city, but I draw a big distinction between the Cubs and the White Sox. I'm just saying that James Shields came out of Tampa. He was basically reared there, and James Shields had a reputation as a guy who could handle anything. So if you want to tell me it's Stanton's personality, I'll agree with you. Or I would accept it is a better way to say it. I would take a shot on Stanton because I think that he may not necessarily be the leader they want, and they can probably address that with another move if that's what they want to do. And I don't think that has to be a big-name guy. I think you can bring in a there are plenty of role players historically who've come in and offered some sort of clubhouse presence, whether it be Kevin Millar, Johnny Gomes, Gabe Kapler, but they need some sort of strong presence from a player standpoint in the clubhouse. Now, look, again, it doesn't mean I'm right. I just think that Stanton is Godzilla, and the Yankees now have Aaron Judge, and the game is clearly headed in a direction where you don't just need power. You need a lot of it. You rattled off the playoff teams. Don't forget the Dodgers too. Now, they were fourth in the National League in home runs with 221, but Milwaukee was first, and they had 224. So The Dodgers hit as many home runs as anybody in the National League. Arizona made the playoffs. They hit the same number of home runs that the Dodgers did. Washington was right there. They hit a ton of home runs. So the game has clearly gone in that direction. I just want the big enchilada. I want, you know, to me, no, and I believe in this practically, that the Red Sox should always be in the market for the best players. I'm not saying there aren't potential concerns or pitfalls, because there are, but to me, I go after the best players and then worry about the rest later.
Yeah, another concern I have with Stan is just the durability factor. I mean, he's a guy that since 2012 has played in more than 125 games in a season twice. Last year, it was a career high 159. The durability and the contract with the $295 million, coupled with the fact that I don't think that his demeanor is suited for Boston, those are all red flags to me. I mean, I love Stanton as a player. Don't get confused. I just don't think he's a fit here.
So I'm not as worried about the durability as you are with a position player. I worry about it more with a pitcher than I do a position player, although maybe the risks are inherent in every pitcher. But with the position guys, especially in the case of Stanton, one of those years he got hit in the face with a pitch. Now, look, there are issues with his legs. He's had some hamstring and knee issues and things like that. So I suppose those are legit concerns. But I also think that in the American League, longer term, he's probably going to end up DHing. So, you know, the idea that he would have to play some sort of major defensive position, center field, shortstop, that doesn't exist. And I think even if he can't move well, he could always play left field at Fenway Park. It's one of the luxuries.
Yeah. If Manny can play it, Stanton can play it, right?
Yeah, Manny can play it. Anyone can play it. To me, it's that simple. So, look, I'm not telling you that there aren't risks. There are. And I think you can come up with risks with every player if you wanted to. Some are more real than others. Again, I just believe that the Red Sox are in a position as a big market team to be in the market for the best players. If their logic is that they don't want to commit to a big contract, well, to me, that's a bad way to go about it, because one, that's the advantage you have over smaller market teams. And two, that means you're never going to be in the market for the best players when they pop up on occasions like this. So is it ideal? No, but I still think that a guy like Stanton could make a major change. And if you want a major change, you have to take a little bit of a risk.
So I'm not about the best players. I'm about the best fit. And I think the best fit would be Jose Abreu from the White Sox. And there was a report by John Heyman of FanRag Sports that the White Sox have engaged the Red Sox and vice versa in discussions about Abreu. He's a power-hitting first baseman, a guy from Cuba. The Red Sox were interested in him when he came out of Cuba and teams were bidding on him. But you look at Jose Abreu in his career, he's a 3,100 guy. I mean, he has averaged for his career to this point, 4 years in, 31 homers a season, and he's driven in more than 100 runs every year. He's right-handed power. He's at first base, which is a position that they need. Abreu, for me, is the guy at the top of my list, Maz.
So I like the Abreu idea, too. And I'll admit that when I heard it, I went, oh, I don't hate it, which for me is a big step.
That's so, true. You hate everything.
Well, I generally, you know, there are certain things that really perk up my antenna and other things that don't. And so he's a complete hitter. He's a more complete hitter than Stanton is. He can hit the ball all over the ballpark. He's a 300 hitter basically for his career. And he can drive the ball out of the ballpark to the opposite field. He doesn't have the raw power Stanton has, not that many people do. So to me, all things being equal, if I could have one or the other, I would take Stanton over Abreu. But you obviously have to factor in length of contract, talent acquisition cost, all of that sort of stuff. So if you told me they end up with Abreu, I'm not going to cry. I'll be okay with that. It's a good secondary option, depending on what the ultimate cost is and what you have, Chris. I'll tell you, one of the things that really interests me about this story is what the cost is going to be for Abreu relative to what it ultimately is for Stanton, wherever he ends up. Because there are reports out there that the San Francisco Giants are in on Stanton and that they're willing to eat the whole contract. Now, we'll see how this thing plays out. But if San Francisco takes on the whole contract and has to give up comparable talent to what the Red Sox would have to give up for Abreu, let's just say it plays out that way, would you rather give up a decent prospect, let's say, or one good prospect for Abreu on a two-year deal, or give it up for Stanton on a 10-year deal?
Well, Stanton has the opt-out, though, after 2020, right? So, I mean, if Stanton doesn't like it, he can bounce, and he has big money, whereas Abreu is a guy who would become a free agent after 2019, right?
So I'll tell you what, let's assume he opts out. Again, comparable talent that you're giving up. Would you rather have Stanton for 3 years or Abreu for two?
I would rather have Abreu for two because I just think he's a better fit. I mean, he's already in the American League. I think he'll handle the market better. He's at first base. I think when the Red Sox have gotten in trouble in the past, Tony, it's because they're going after the biggest name and they're not really focusing on whether this guy fits, whether he fits, you know, on the field, off the field, everything that goes with playing for the Red Sox.
Well, it's a fair stance to take. They've had difficulty there at the same time. And I know it wasn't this ownership. They don't win their first two World Series without Manny Ramirez, whom they signed to a blockbuster contract. And Pedro Martinez, when they traded for him, they signed him to what was then a record contract. So I just think that the landscape has changed. The metrics have changed. The scale entirely has changed. You have to recalibrate. So that $30 million for a guy like Stanton sounds like a ton of money. But a year from now, there are going to be guys that are getting 40.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I just think in the case of Stanton, I would rather, and again, I might be wrong about the prospects. I just think because of the magnitude of the Stanton deal, that the acquisition cost in terms of talent that you have to give up for him is not going to be as high as people think.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it certainly could be. All right, we're going to continue this discussion with Tony Maserati of 98.5 The Sports Hub in a little bit, but we have to take a brief time out here on Season Ticket. When we come back with Tony, we're going to talk about whether Jackie Bradley Jr. is on the trading block and whether maybe the Red Sox need to upgrade some starting pitching as well. Stay tuned for that. Welcome back. If you like Season Ticket, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Remember, subscribing is the best way to make sure you get our latest episode as soon as it's available. Back here with Tony Maserati from 98.5 The Sports Hub. We're going to continue our baseball conversation now. We talked a lot about Jose Abreu. You know I love him, Maz. One of the players that the White Sox potentially could be interested in if they make a deal with the Red Sox for Abreu is Jackie Bradley Jr., center fielder for the Red Sox. We all know Jackie Bradley Jr. can be really streaky, and he's not really consistent. Last year didn't have a great year offensively, 245, 17 home runs. The on-base percentage was just 323. If the White Sox came to me and said, yeah, we need Jackie Bradley Jr. to center this package for Jose Abreu, I would race to the airport with Jackie Bradley Jr. and do that deal.
Yeah, I don't think you'd be alone. I'd go with you. Like, I'd help. I'd pay for the gas. At some point you look at it and say, well, Jackie Bradley is all well and good, and he's a fabulous defensive player. We all know that. At the same time, in the last two postseasons, Jackie Bradley is 4-for-26 and he has struck out 13 times.
Wow.
Okay. So half the time he's gone up in the postseason, he has struck out. He is three times as likely to strike out than get a hit. And it's not as if he is a guy like Stanton who's in the process hitting you 50 home runs. This past regular season, Bradley hit 17. Last year it was 26, and he had a good year, although albeit a streaky one. But the reality is he's a bottom-of-the-lineup hitter. Andrew Benintendi could play a functional center field. If Jackie Bradley is an obstacle to this kind of deal, then Dave Dombrowski should be relieved of his duties immediately. The fact is that Bradley should not be an obstacle to this kind of trade.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's not going to be just Jackie Bradley Jr., but maybe he could be a big part of that deal, and you're throwing in maybe a Michael Chavis, who's a big prospect for the Red Sox, first base prospect. I don't know what's left, really, in that farm system. There's not a lot left there. It's sort of been strip mined to build this team, which goes to a point that I want to make about this offseason overall, Maz, and something you and I have talked about before. This offseason is so important for the Red Sox because, really, the way their team is constructed, they have a three-year window to win a championship, and they already wasted one of those years in 2017. But after this season, after 2018, Drew Pomeranz can be a free agent. Craig Kimbrell can be a free agent. David Price could opt out. After 2019, Rick Porcello can be a free agent. Xander Bogaerts can be a free agent. So they're in a win-now mode. They don't really have time to sort of wait and upgrade this team. And I think that's something that should be playing into the thinking of Dave Dombrowski.
Well, Chris, I felt this last offseason. I felt it was a three-year window that they really made a commitment to win in a short period of time. Now, look, that can change if they are able to re-sign Mookie Betts, Bogarts, and we used to have Bradley in that discussion. I don't think he's really part of that conversation anymore. To me, it's Betts and Bogarts. Those are now the centerpiece guys. It's really more Betts. But this is also part of the reason I feel like they should go after a guy like Stanton. They don't have any huge long-term commitments outside of price now, and that's a big one. They can take on the money with a guy like Stanton and worry about the back end of the deal later because nobody has that kind of money committed long-term. So, you know, you look at all of that and you say you built this thing for the now, and then you're going to balk at making a big acquisition that could put you over the top. It doesn't seem consistent to me.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's one reason that one thing that's flying under the radar this offseason, as we talk about needing a big bat and upgrading the power, is the starting pitching, because that's sort of what has undone them, in my opinion, the last two postseasons. And look, I expect Chris Sale to pitch better than he did against the Houston Astros in the American League Division Series, but I still look at their rotation and say, well, do I really trust Drew Pomerantz in the playoffs? You know, I was sort of saying that all year long. The guy had a great year. He won 18 games, but I was like, when we get to the playoffs, I don't really trust this guy. And do you trust Rick Porcello? So one guy that I think could help them potentially is this Shohei Ohtani, the Japanese Babe Ruth. He's this great pitcher and also somebody who can hit. And apparently he's going to try and do both in the major leagues. But to me, that's a relatively inexpensive way to upgrade or potentially upgrade your starting staff. What do you think of Ohtani, and what do you think of the Red Sox needing to upgrade the starting pitching staff?
Okay, so generally speaking, I don't feel like you do about the starting pitching, and only because I feel like they've invested enough there. I'm not thrilled about the way the pitching has performed in the postseason either. How could you be? But I also feel like, how many resources are they going to throw at the starting pitching before they say enough? Because it's already cost them so many resources that on some level, they can't now go make the Giancarlo Stanton deal because they don't want to give up prospects. However, I'm intrigued by Ohtani. I don't know how you can't be, given the unique skill set that he has. And big league people believe that he will be able to do both in the big leagues, which to me is the tell-all. It's one thing to say, okay, the guy hit and pitched in Japan. It's another thing to say he can do it in the major leagues. So if you're telling me you can address your pitching potentially and at the same time take a chance that maybe you got a hitter on top of it, a guy that can help you in two areas, I'm all for it. And honestly, purely for the novelty factor I'm in, I think this guy could be potentially a trailblazer, a barrier breaker, who opens up a whole new way of thinking with how to use players, particularly pitchers who can hit. And if he can do it, maybe teams will be willing to try it with other players. So it's like having a 26th man on the roster. I love it. I want to see this guy play no matter where he is. I would love for it to be Boston.
Yeah, Tony. And the great thing about Ohtani is he's not going to cost a ton of money because of the posting system and the way things work in Major League Baseball with international signings. The most he can get as a bonus is $3.5 million. I think a lot of Red Sox fans remember Daisuke Matsuzaka coming to the Red Sox. The posting fee was $51.1 million, and then they had to sign him to a $52 million deal. So the outlay overall was $103 million. It's like $100 million less if you end up with Ohtani. He'd be a real bargain if the Red Sox can convince him to come here. All right, I want to flip things over to basketball. And Tony, you get, I think, a lot of blowback, I guess is the best way of putting it, from people on your basketball opinions. But one thing you've been very consistent on is that you really are very bullish on the Philadelphia 76ers, who are in town tonight to play the Boston Celtics. Who do you think has the brightest future here, the Sixers or the Celtics?
Well, so look, it's hard to not say the Celtics right now because of Kyrie Irving. So Irving is the one guy that we can look at on both teams and say, absolutely, positively, can be a star in the NBA and win a championship because he's done it. So that is an advantage the Celtics have over Philly. But if I were to ask you right now, of all the players on the rosters of both teams right now, who has the highest upside to be the best player? To me, it's Embiid.
Yeah, so, it's probably followed by Simmons after that.
Okay, so I look at that and I say, if I'm starting a franchise from rock bottom today and I have to pick a guy to build around, and again, it's a slow build, I would probably take Embiid off of those two rosters. I just think his skill set is wildly unique. When he was in college, there were people comparing him to Hakeem Olajuwon, and I thought, well, that's ridiculous. Then you see him play, and you think, you know what? Maybe it's not that ridiculous, and he can shoot from three-point distance on top of it. So, look, I just think Philly's accumulated a lot of talent there. And the only difference between how they did it and how Danny Ainge did it is that Ainge didn't want to stink at the same time. So they had Isaiah Thomas. They had a bridge team because Brooklyn was able to get in the lottery for the Celtics. Okay, the Celtics could go out and put a representative team on the floor and be in the lottery at the same time because they had those Brooklyn picks. How Ainge was able to pull off that trick is a something that nobody should try to do again in the NBA. It was a tough pull, but he pulled it off. Philly, I mean, the Celtics have Tatum and Brown, and everybody loves those two guys as the harbinger of the future, and they are, and they're good players now. Philly's done the same thing through the lottery. Embiid was the third pick. Simmons was the first pick. Markel Fultz is the first pick, and maybe he'll turn into something, maybe he won't. But the point is, you're not going to hit on all of them, just like Marcus Smart might not be quite the player that the Celtics thought he was going to be. Philly's young talent is as good as any young talent in the league.
I agree with that. You know how I feel about Jaylen Brown. I mean, I think his upside is right there with Simmons and Embiid just because of the freak physical talent that he is. I think the difference, though, is the Celtics have young guys like that, but they also have superstars who are in their primes, in Kyrie Irving, in Gordon Hayward, who is hurt right now, obviously, but expected to come back and be the same guy. These are star players, all-star caliber players who are already in their primes. And on top of that, you have Tatum and Jaylen Brown and more picks to come. So I would say the Celtics, when you watch the Sixers, they're one of the most fun teams to watch in the NBA. I mean, what Simmons can do at his size as a passer, and I saw it at LSU, it's absolutely mesmerizing. But that being said, when I look at the Celtics and what they have in terms of having core guys who are already in their primes, that makes a difference to me. And the 76ers, you look at their starting lineup, it's really good, but that bench, they have no depth. And the Celtics have a lot of depth. What's also interesting to me about this, Maz, is that these two teams are intertwined now because of that Markel Fultz deal. And I think people are going to judge these two teams sort of on that deal. Like, who gets the upper hand in that deal at the end of the day? Was it the Celtics or was it the 76ers who end up with Fultz and they get it back-to-back number one picks in Simmons and Fultz?
Yeah, Chris, look, for those of us who grew up in the 80s, this is like turning back the clock. I'm a little older than you. But, you know, the other team that's been involved in those high drafts in the last few years is the Lakers. So you have Philly, the Lakers, and the Celtics all picking from the same crop of talent, basically over a period of, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years, however long this plays out. And don't forget, the Celtics could potentially have the Lakers pick if it lands between 2 and 5 in next year's draft, right? So again, there's a link there as well with Philly. Yeah. You know, there are so many connections between these teams, and I think they're all going to be good. The question is who's going to be the best, and there's no question, as you pointed out, that the Celtics have the better established veteran players and superstars, and I forgot Hayward because he hasn't played, but they've been able to augment it through free agency, even if you throw Horford into the mix, who is clearly an accomplished, smart, a winning player, and the Celtics have that and the other two teams do not. But even if, like, look at Philly's roster, Dario Saric, there's a guy the Celtics were linked to when he was in the draft.
Yeah,
they didn't
take
him. Yeah, he ended up in Philly. So there's another guy that you look at and say, well, the Celtics could have had him. They opted not to. So these teams are going to be going head to head. I think Ainge knows it. I think Stevens knows it. I think the Celtics would have taken Embiid if he had fallen to them in that draft, not that he was going to get by number three. I think Ainge has even gone on record as saying that he was in their top three. So I don't think that that's anything revelatory. But, there's been a lot of talk about how the teams have taken a different approach to building these things. And at the end of the day, I really don't think it's that different. I think it's just that the Celtics got someone else to be in the lottery for them, which allowed Ainge to maybe make some trades and do some things that the other teams couldn't do. But otherwise, the Lakers, the Sixers, and the Celtics have all been pulling players out of the high lottery for the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree a little because I think the Celtics have been able to do some stuff on parallel tracks, right? So, yes, you're right. Like the Sixers, they're in the lottery, but they're also making some trades. And the Isaiah Thomas trade was a big one, so it was a Kyrie Irving trade. And, yes, the Brooklyn pick they had remaining in 2018 did facilitate that deal. The other thing, though, is they sign premium free agents in Horford and Hayward. The Sixers haven't done that yet. And the question is, will they get to that point? Will somebody look at their young core and say, yeah, we're going to go to Philadelphia now because we know that we can play with Simmons. We can play with Embiid. The other thing about the Sixers, Maz, that worries me a little bit if I'm a Sixers fan is Embiid's health. You know, the fact that he can't play in back-to-back, that he's not going to play or he's not expected to play in tonight's game against the Celtics. The fact that Fultz has this shoulder injury. The fact that Simmons last year had the broken foot. There seems to be something with Philadelphia. I'm not saying they're mishandling these injuries. That's not what I'm saying. Maybe it's just bad luck. But I think there's something there where can you count on Embiid, or is he going to be in a situation where he's, you know, sort of like the Bill Walton of his generation, a great, great player who has his career curtailed and never reaches his potential because he can't stay healthy?
Well, legit. That's a legit concern. Embiid's the big one, though. And if there were injuries there, that dramatically affects what he's doing. Chris, as far as the free agency, and look, I saw this in passing yesterday, but someone had speculated that the Sixers are going to be in the market for LeBron James when he hits free agency next summer. So they haven't signed a free agent yet. And I don't know if LeBron would be drawn to a place like that or not. Everyone certainly feels like he's going to end up in LA and he's going to want veteran players around him anyway. But if you look at it and say, if you're a veteran guy, I mean, Al Horford was drawn to Boston. Why couldn't someone be drawn to Philly? I know I would be.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point, Maz. And we'll see what happens. These two teams are lined up to be rivals for years to come. I think that would certainly be interesting, and it would definitely stoke a lot of nostalgia for Celtics fans who remember the Dr. J Sixers against the Larry Bird Celtics. Well, this was great, Maz. We finally found an NBA team and topic and players that you like and that you like talking about. So I feel like this podcast was a success just on that fact alone.
Well, I like more than you think I do. I just don't sound like it.
Yeah, it's a tonality issue, as you guys like to say, on Felger and Maz. That's Tony Mazzarotti of 98.5 The Sports Hub and the Felger and Maz Show. Maz, thank you so much for joining us here on Season Ticket.
Chris, anytime on Friday, we'll do it again on our turf.
Sounds good to me, Maz. Finally, the cheap seats. There are not many firsts left in LeBron James' career. The three-time NBA champion and four-time NBA MVP has seemingly done it all. But James had a landmark first on Tuesday night in the Cleveland Cavaliers' win over the Miami Heat.
Here comes LeBron, changing gears, bumping and missing. Dying is fouled. He's going to get a tech. And he's out of here! LeBron James has just been ejected!
It was the first time in 1,082 career games that James was ejected. The NBA is a sports league where superstars are given the most preferential treatment by the officials. There's a clear double standard for the hoops haves like James and the hoops have-nots. So James probably deserved to get tossed long before this. According to ESPN stats and information, the only active players who have played more games than James without being ejected are Tony Parker and Pau Gasol of the San Antonio Spurs. However, with LeBron James, I'm going to give him a little bit of leeway here. LeBron's imposing physique means he doesn't get foul calls that smaller, less physically imposing players would get. James' 5.4 free throw attempts per game this season is actually a career low. As the late, great Wilt Chamberlain said, nobody roots for Goliath. It's apparently also harder for Goliath to get a foul call sometimes. But this ejection was an anomaly. James' superstar status ensures that. The most famous play of LeBron's career won't be an ejection, it will remain a rejection. His block in Game 7 of the 2016 NBA Finals against the Golden State Warriors that paved the way for the Cavaliers to win Cleveland's first major pro sports championship since 1964. But on Wednesday night, it was James who got both rejected and ejected, begging for a call. That's it for this edition of Season Ticket, a daily podcast from the Boston Globe Sports Department and WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. If you've enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and leave us a review. I'm Chris Gasper. We'll see you tomorrow.